the timing of this test with the sanctions, the passing of the new sanctions, is certainly not coincidental.
Another nation takes action in response to North Korea. It's Monday, September 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Be sure to join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, stronger child protection laws in Australia. China denounces terrorism in a new way. The evolving Philippines drug war, mosquitoes flying north, drones flying over sharks. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Kuwait is expected to expel North Korea's ambassador to the Gulf country along with four other diplomats. Diplomatic sources told news agencies on the condition of anonymity that North Korea's diplomatic presence in the oil-rich state will be reduced to a charge d'affaires and three diplomats. The announcement comes 2 days after North Korea launched another missile over Japan and less than a week after the United Nations imposed additional sanctions on Pyongyang for conducting its sixth nuclear test. The reduction in diplomatic staff in Kuwait could limit North Korea's ability to earn money for its nuclear program through thousands of North Korean workers in Kuwait, as some reports say the embassy has also decided not to renew work permits for North Koreans. The missile on Friday was launched from the Sunan district in the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, and the second to fly over the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. Ian Williams, associate director of the Missile Defense Program at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, tells VOA's Sarah Williams more about this latest launch.
It did fly over Hokkaido, Japan. This was like the previous test on August 28th. It flew about 3,700 kilometers. It flew to an altitude of about 770 kilometers, which is a little bit higher than previous tests. And it flew for 19 minutes, which is interesting because that's quite a bit faster than the previous test on August 28th, which was about 32 minutes. That does suggest that we could be looking at something new, something different than the last test. We haven't gotten full confirmation on what the missile exactly was, but I would say that flight time does suggest it could be something different, but we'll have to wait to see.
Well, apparently this type of missile, it was capable of, say, flying towards Guam.
That's correct. That is correct, yes.
What do you think is the significance of this particular path that it took? Why did North Korea decide to send it in this direction?
Well, it does get a lot of attention when they fly over, you know, the territory of another country, of Japan in particular, given the hostilities between the countries. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, if you're looking at developing missiles, which they are certainly doing, based on North Korea's geography, if you want to fly a missile on a kind of operational trajectory, there's not many other places you can go. You can fly over China, which I don't think they would do. You could fly over South Korea, which would put it in the sights of U.S. missile defenses in South Korea and in Guam. So over Japan is really the only other direction that you can go. They could continue doing, you know, earlier in the year, they were doing a lot of lofted trajectories, meaning they would fly the missile very high, but not very far, and they would land in the Sea of Japan. But if you're developing missiles meant for combat operations, eventually you're going to need to see how they fly on a combat operational trajectory.
Does this most recent launch indicate that North Korea is just continuing to develop its missile program?
It certainly does. It wasn't a huge surprise to see that they did this again. Certainly, they seem to have a kind of a dual track, dual purpose, in my opinion. They're, on the one hand, looking to develop their missiles technologically, but they're also using their missile development programs and the timing of their tests certainly to send a message as a way of objecting to certain things. Certainly, the timing of this test with the sanctions, the passing of the new sanctions, certainly not coincidental.
Ian Williams, Associate Director of the Missile Defense Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies right here in Washington. While debate continues in Washington about how the latest round of sanctions against North Korea could have been tougher, patience is wearing thin in Beijing with China's longtime ally and communist neighbor. VOA's Bill Ide has this report from Beijing.
Korean shop signs line the streets outside the North Korean embassy in the Chinese capital of Beijing, where a big construction project is underway. China has long been one of Pyongyang's biggest backers, but its actions are threatening the relationship and fueling concerns among the public.
It's dangerous. This is all happening right next door, a neighbor that is so close. North Korea has been researching and developing nuclear weapons for a long time, and almost all of the international community is opposed to that effort, and yet it continues to go its own way.
Despite all that China has done to selflessly help North Korea, she adds, Pyongyang has done little to repay Beijing, and clearly has no bottom line. China's basic position on North Korea has long been one of three no's: no war, no nukes, and no instability. But with North Korea's repeated missile and ICBM launches, as well as its latest nuclear test, Beijing has had little choice but to join the international community in taking steps that, over time, could trigger instability, analysts say. Support for a tougher approach is growing in China, even though there is still skepticism about the effectiveness of sanctions or whether Kim Jong-un really means what he says.
I support sanctions if they don't impact the people of North Korea that much. Sanctions on the leadership should be tougher.
The best thing would be for everyone to sit down and talk. And I think China should play a mediating role.
Talks with North Korea have been stalled for nearly a decade. Analysts in China say that while the United States may have wanted an all-out embargo on oil exports, the 30% cut is still going to have a significant impact and could be enough to push Pyongyang to ponder whether it should re-engage. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
We invite you to see Bill Ide's story and read more by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Former CIA chief warns of North Korea's other nuclear weapon. Bangladesh limits Rohingya travel, begins immunizing children. Indian Prime Minister Modi inaugurates controversial dam project. Pakistan's provincial authorities seek to identify educated radicals. China builds an Orlando aside its Vegas and New York. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Australia is insisting that new child protection laws are the greatest crackdown on pedophiles in a generation. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports, Canberra says the measures will include longer prison terms for child abusers.
Australian officials say punishments handed down to pedophiles have been too lax. The government wants them to spend more time behind bars for their crimes, and plans to bring in mandatory minimum sentences for convicted child sex offenders. They'd be similar to the automatic prison terms given to terrorists and people smugglers. Officials say the new measures will properly reflect the disgust the community has at those who prey on children. Australian Justice Minister Michael Keenan says the current laws are not strict enough.
I don't think it is as tough as the Australian people assume that it should be. Now, we've found that less than 60% of people who are convicted of Commonwealth child sex offenders actually serve time in prison. And of those that do go to prison, the most common length of time that they serve is just 6 months. I don't think the Australian people would think that's acceptable. And that's why we're very keen to change it, to make sure that they serve a mandatory minimum time when they commit these horrendous offences against children.
The legislation will make it more difficult for child sex offenders in Australia to be granted bail and parole. There'll also be tougher measures to crack down on online grooming, which will allow Australian police to intervene sooner if a suspect is found to be contacting a child with the intention of carrying out a crime. Internet companies which don't immediately report abusive content to the authorities will face tougher fines. In June, Australia passed new laws to stop convicted paedophiles from travelling overseas on so-called child rape holidays. The measures gave officials the power to strip paedophiles of their passports. Later this year, Australia's most comprehensive inquiry into child abuse is expected to publish its findings, into the widespread mistreatment of children in institutions, including church groups, sporting clubs, schools, and the military. The Royal Commission began hearing evidence from survivors of abuse in 2013. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Vietnam's central coast is recovering after heavy rains and wind lashed it following Typhoon Doksuri that left at least four people dead and more than 100,000 homes damaged. It caused 300,000 residents to flee the area as authorities urged mass evacuations ahead of the storm, with officials predicting it could be the most powerful in a decade. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. A decision by the BRICS nations to name and denounce specific terrorist organizations in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere is sparking debate among academics and analysts in China. Earlier this month, the group, comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, extended their support to Kabul's counterterrorism efforts during a meeting in China. This was the first time China had publicly denounced Pakistan-based terror groups, which had earlier been censured by the United Nations Security Council. Islamabad had reasons to worry about a possible change in Beijing's attitude, especially at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump had threatened to cut off aid if Pakistan did not change its approach to terrorism. While Pakistan appeared unhappy with the BRICS declaration, Afghanistan seemed pleased, as Ahmad Bilal Khalil, a researcher at the Center for Strategic and Regional Studies in Kabul, tells VOA.
Afghanistan has welcomed it because it is somehow aligned with the Afghanist regional outreach program. Afghanistan and Afghan must believe that it's, the current situation in Afghanistan is not an internal Afghan war. Because we believe that it has an original linkage, or there are, for example, farmers are fighting in Afghanistan, there are Uyghurs, there are Uzbeks, there are even Chechens, Pakistanis are fighting. So it's somehow a regional war. And in order to curb regional outreach and a regional consensus, it must.
Analysts say China was seriously worried about Islamabad's inability to curb terrorists residing in Pakistan, which Beijing has accused of causing widespread terror in China's western region of Xinjiang, home to the country's Muslim minority and Uyghur population. Beijing is also worried that rising terrorism might pose serious obstacles to the safety of Chinese citizens engaged in the construction of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Analysts say China, Russia, and India desperately need ground intelligence in Afghanistan, as well as in the tribal areas of Pakistan, because their homegrown terrorists are closely linked to the Taliban and other militant groups. Lee Brandstetter, an associate professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon University's Hines School of Policy and Management, tells VOA the BRICS declaration also condemned two Pakistan-based terror groups who have been accused by India of conducting attacks in its cities, and the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which is active in China's Xinjiang region.
So Russia and China and India have all had issues with terrorist groups that claim to be motivated by religion, right? That claim to be acting in the name of Islam.
Brandstetter says an important question is whether the BRICS effort will complement or compete with the efforts of the United States in the battle against terrorism.
All of these nations have a common interest in acting against Islamic terrorism. All of these countries have cooperated with the United States in efforts to deal with this problem in the past. And so it's actually not that surprising that these three nations would make the statements that they have made against the Haqqani Network and the Taliban.
Chinese experts are divided on this issue ahead of a crucial Communist Party Congress in October, which will determine the next set of leaders after 2017. We thank reporter Saibal Dasgupta in Beijing for contributing this report. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Bangladesh will use troops to deliver foreign aid to the border town that has been overwhelmed by Rohingya Muslim refugees from Myanmar. The aid will be distributed to conflict areas via military helicopters in coordination with the Rakhine State government as uncertainty and security concerns continue in the region. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte could be rethinking the scope of his deadly anti-drug campaign after the slayings of three teenagers angered an otherwise supported public. In mid-August, 17-year-old high school student Kian Lloyd de los Santos was shot to death in a city north of the capital, Manila, possibly at the hands of police. That death sparked street demonstrations in Manila and a 40-day bell-ringing protest by the Catholic Church. Last week, a 19-year-old man was found shot to death, and the body of a 14-year-old boy turned up full of stab wounds. Investigators are probing the police over both incidents. The case has threatened to erode support for Duterte's otherwise popular anti-drug campaign, which has come under fire from overseas for its use of extrajudicial killings. The tough-spoken 72-year-old president approved the campaign after he took office in June 2016 on pledges to wipe out drugs within 6 months. Analysts like Eduardo Ararel, associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School, say the policy of extrajudicial killings is being tried online.
Clearly, in social media, popular media, there's a widespread anger in the manner that the teenagers were killed, that they are guilty or not. I think the police would have to be more careful this time because of the backlash and because they know that if they cross the line in terms of police operations, the president will not necessarily back them up.
Duterte has pledged via the presidential office website a thorough and impartial investigation into the death of De Los Santos. Experts say Duterte's slap at the police may be a sign that he will refine his violent approach to drugs without calling it off. Duterte had temporarily lightened up in February with a new focus on stopping excesses by the Philippine National Police after the death of a Korean businessman in custody. After De Los Santos died last month, the Philippine Star Online quoted Duterte saying he would not condone killing innocent people. Any shift in the drug campaign, which New York-based advocacy group Human Rights Watch estimates has led to 7,000 extrajudicial killings, would be intermittent or gradual. Analysts like Herman Kraft, a political scientist at the University of the Philippines Diliman, warn it may just mean that police will act more carefully around minors and especially while in view of surveillance cameras.
I think the overall objectives and the strategy is still going to maintain. That's pretty much how President Duterte laid out his basic strategy behind the war on drugs. There just might be some holding back if it actually involves young people.
Duterte's government had earned the satisfaction of 75% of Filipinos in the first quarter of 2017. Metro Manila-based research institution Social Weather Stations found that figure. It said 66% of people were satisfied with the anti-drug campaign. Survey agency Pulse Asia found in March that 79% of people approve of the government's effort to control crime. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this report. This news alert from VOA Asia, Singapore has its first woman president. After Halima Yacob was inaugurated, she was the only person put forward for the position, this time reserved for candidates from the minority Malay community. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. Across the tundra, the rapid changes are affecting creatures large and small. And that includes the ferocious Arctic mosquito and the caribou it torments. VOA's Steve Barragona tells us it's a snapshot of how climate change is rippling through the entire ecosystems around the world.
Summer in Greenland. Life makes the most of this short season of long days before the harsh winter returns. Caribou graze, flowers bloom, and mosquitoes swarm by the millions.
It can be quite miserable.
Dartmouth College ecologist Lauren Culler studies the web of life in these Arctic ponds. She says each year as the ice melts, a battle for survival begins between the larvae of mosquitoes and of beetles.
There are just thousands of mosquitoes within sight, and then you'll see these beetles come through and just grab one, and then they feed like spiders feed. They inject these digestive enzymes first, and they liquefy the internal contents of the prey and suck it back up.
The mosquitoes that escape that fate emerge from the water and go looking for caribou or other animals to bite. The caribou face so many mosquitoes that they flee from their grazing grounds, losing precious time to fatten up for the winter. Culler thought climate change might give the beetles an edge and cut down on the mosquito hordes.
In warmer conditions, the beetles actually consume more mosquito larvae per day. So one of the things we looked at was, is it that more mosquitoes are being eaten in a warmer year, so fewer are likely to emerge? That was kind of what we thought would happen.
It did not. In warmer water, mosquitoes matured a few days faster.
That's 3 or 4 fewer days where you have the potential risk of being eaten by one of those predaceous diving beetles. And in the simulations that we did, we found that that actually really matters and that the mosquitoes win in that situation.
When mosquitoes win, caribou may lose. Fewer may survive the winter. But the tundra holds more enemies for mosquitoes than just beetles.
We're also investigating how the spiders might play a role in controlling mosquito emergence, because they seem to be able to cue in on the ponds right when the mosquitoes are emerging.
Locked up in ice for much of the year, tundra ecosystems are simpler than those in warmer climates. Untangling the web of connections here offers a taste of the complex ways climate change is altering the rest of the planet. Steve Barragona, VOA News, outside Kangerlussuaq, Greenland.
It's still true that a person is more likely to be struck by lightning than attacked by a shark. But that doesn't matter much to the 150 or so people who experienced what the International Shark Attack File calls shark-human interaction in 2016. Still, VOA's Kevin Enix reports that some Australian eyes in the skies are helping lifeguards to look out for predators just offshore.
It takes complicated algorithms, but this camera-equipped drone is able to distinguish a shark from a dolphin or a surfer.
As of now, studies have shown that human accuracy with shark detection from aerial images are around between 20% to 30% max. So, whereas if a computer does that in an automated way, which we have already achieved an accuracy of more than 90%.
Starting in September, camera-equipped drones will patrol some Australian beaches, monitoring the water from the air and sending real information on anything potentially dangerous in the water.
So in this project, we are training the algorithms with many samples of shark, whales, different types of boats, surfers, and many other objects around, which are commonly seen or found near the beaches.
The drone is called a Little Ripper, and the company that develops the autonomous flyers wants it to do a lot more than just identify sharks in the water.
In the marine environment, like beaches, we drop a life raft, which is a 4-person life raft. It also has an EPIRB, which is one of these things that talks to a satellite and says, help, please help me, and I'm here. We're developing a electronic shark repellent, so if there's a shark present, that stops the shark from attacking. And we have other things like the world's smallest defibrillator we can drop if that's required.
It is still incredibly unlikely you will ever run afoul of a shark, but this kind of tech will add one more layer of safety for Australian beachgoers. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and you don't need a drone to find us in Tainan, Taiwan. You can hear us by tuning your radio to the voice of Chungrung Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University, Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who's listening today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter. Chung has been engineering us for today, manning our audio controls. Thank you so much. Managing editor, Diane Gao. David Bird, Ali Ogden, Ira Melman, all a part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.